Blog Talk Radio.
Well, a boy's best friend is his mother.
We can agree on that, Jerry. He was Hitchcock actually really admired Herman's contribution, particularly to Psycho, and he said,
"Oh yeah,
you made the movie what it is in large part." Of course, Herman and Hitchcock, the collaboration between the two of them was legendary. You know, you think of all those great scores. Did North by Northwest, that was Herman as well.
I think a lot
of Hitchcock's films, yeah.
Yeah, and remember, you know, the great thing about Bernard Herrmann is he comes and scores De Palma's Obsession.
Mm-hmm.
That was always beautiful. That was always a beautiful touch.
Yeah, yeah, and that seems right in line with, De Palma's sensibilities at that time.
Yeah.
So tonight we're going to be talking about Psycho, but it's not just limited to Psycho. It's going to be kind of a celebration of Mr. Hitchcock and his work, which we haven't really done on the show before. Discuss much of Hitchcock, surprisingly. So, Jerry, favorite Hitchcock films of yours?
Lifeboat, Strangers on the Train, Vertigo, Notorious. I think Notorious may be my all-time favorite, but I think Lifeboat or Strangers on the Train might be definitely later in life. I love Family Plot. We talked about that last time, and that's towards the end. Obviously, The Birds. But that's like, you know, one of those early films, like, when you're 4 or 5, you discover, and you're just like, you know, you never look at birds on a telephone wire the same ever again after watching that film. I'm sorry. Even to this day, you know, when I see the, you know, birds, I'm like, oh, my God, it's like Hitchcock. Or the Saturday Night Live parody, The Clams, directed by Brian De Palma. I don't know if you've ever seen that commercial on SNL.
Yeah, I think I have.
That was hysterical. I mean, that was in 1980 or 81. That was just crazy. But I would have to say I like North by Northwest a lot. Rear Window, which I saw on the theater, countless re-releases. That's awesome. But, yeah, I mean, there's just so many to choose from. I mean, he was just incredible. I mean, he was a man who knew too much. I mean, there's just, like, so much you could... It just depends what kind of mood you're in. But he was a genius. They don't make him like that anymore.
A wealth of great films, and the
yeah.
thing obviously that set him apart was
yeah.
his understanding of the visual language and his understanding of what constituted suspense.
Yeah.
And that's one of his most famous quotes. He said, you know, suspense and surprise are two different things. And he always talked about the concept of a couple at a dinner table
mm-hmm.
and there's a bomb underneath the table, but nobody knows it. The audience doesn't know. No one knows it. Mm-hmm. They go on talking for 4 minutes, and then the thing explodes, and audiences get a big jump. Now, he said what he does is suspense, where he shows at the very beginning of their dinner table, restaurant table conversation, the bomb at the bottom of their table. So as inane as their conversation might be, that creates a sense of extreme anticipation and anxiety on the audience's part, knowing that that thing's going to blow any minute.
Right.
He said, that's the difference for me. And he was a master at it. And just in terms of visual design, just watching North by Northwest again, and that movie really is, for a good hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes of that film, it's a chase.
Yeah.
It's a chase film. Mm-hmm. And he understood, as much ink has been devoted to his relationship with actors, mm-hmm. where he said they should be treated like cattle, he understood how to use them in a very special way. I mean, obviously Cary Grant in North by Northwest is one of the ultimate movie star performances, mm-hmm. but Anthony Perkins, this perfectly odd jewel of a performance in the middle of Psycho. I mean,
yeah.
that, and you knew that wasn't that was under the tutelage of Hitchcock. I mean, it had to have been designed as a collaboration between he and Perkins to come up with that just offbeat, completely original character.
Right.
What's also interesting about Psycho? Psycho stands apart from his other films.
Mm-hmm.
It feels grittier. It feels not as sophisticated. That's not an insult.
No.
Just in terms of it feels like a really kind of visceral, down and dirty kind of thriller. And it's dealing with a lot of themes that were obviously taboo in 1960 when this film was released.
Right.
I mean, you know, digging up your mother, cross-dressing.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm embarrassed to tell you what age is the first time I watched this film. It was on TV. I believe I watched this when I was 4 or 5.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that explains it.
Nah, that doesn't explain it to me, but that's when I first saw it. I mean, that's when I really, my first earliest memory of Psycho is 4 or 5. I remember everyone watching it downstairs, and I was like, yeah, let's watch this.
I remember vividly seeing it when I was little, and then I saw it in the theater. And there are shots that stick with me in the film.
Oh yeah,
the shot of when he's watching the car sink,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of turns around, and the camera just kind of cranes into him,
mm-hmm.
with this demonic look on his face. That's a favorite moment of mine. A favorite shot of mine. It's incredible. Let's get to our first interview here, our only interview for the show. This is a lengthy one because this is the expert on Psycho and Hitchcock, and we're so happy to welcome him to the show, Stephen Rebello. He's an accomplished writer and screenwriter, and his articles and interviews have appeared in the pages of GQ, Playboy, the LA Times, Movie Line, and dozens of additional prestigious publications. His books include Real Art, Great Posters from the Golden Age of the Silver Screen, Bad Movies We Love, and Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, a chronicle that film critic Richard Schickel called one of the best accounts of the making of an individual movie we've ever had. Now that book is being made into a feature film for which Rebello will serve as screenwriter and executive producer, and we do talk about that a little bit towards the end of this interview. Here's Mr. Rebello to tell us all about his relationship with Hitchcock and his deep insight into Hitch's creative process, as well as the risky project that we've become one of Mr. Hitchcock's most revered classics. Here's Stephen. I read that you went to school, you studied literature and clinical psychology, if I understand correctly.
I double majored, yeah.
Yeah. Did those two complement one another for you?
Well, that wasn't apparent at first, but I mean, I actually did pursue a career in clinical psychology, and I actually was a therapist for about 10 years in Boston. I was at a Harvard teaching hospital, and but always on the side I was writing.
I
figured I needed to figure out a way to make a living that I really liked. And, you know, I'm endlessly fascinated by people, and so I did that and was very successful at it, and it was very gratifying for me. But as I was saying, all the time during that I was writing and, you know, getting things published, and then finally I decided to, you know, make a break and actually pursue writing full time, mm-hmm. and it was actually Hitchcock who helped me do that.
And that was your first meeting with him, I believe, was your last year at Harvard, is that correct?
Well, I have a strange history with Mr. Hitchcock. He is always Mr. Hitchcock to me, except when I'm writing the screenplay, version of the book, and then he becomes someone very different from Mr. Hitchcock. But I do think of him as Mr. Hitchcock. When I was a kid, I grew up in southern New England in Massachusetts, and very poor parents, very wonderful parents, but you know, we didn't have a lot of money. But my mother would come home from work, and I'd be talking. I'm not joking. I'd be talking to Alfred Hitchcock on the phone. I'd call him.
No kidding.
He would take the calls. Not so weird. If you know me, it's not so weird that I would call him. I tend to be fearless, at least on the surface. But pretty remarkable in the fact that he would take phone calls, as did, by the way, William Castle, his rival. But, we had a couple of very childlike on my part, but, very lovely conversations. And I met him actually at the premiere of Torn Curtain, which took place, the world premiere of Torn Curtain happened to take place in Boston. And, I didn't drive then, but a friend of mine drove me to the premiere. I remember it was 10 o'clock in the morning. There were actually pictures of me. That appeared in newspapers, but anyway, there was a mob. It was a public premiere, and there really were a mob of people. It was in a very beautiful movie, a true movie palace, in the grand old style, the music hall in Boston. And they rolled out a 50-layer cake with the titles of all of Mr. Hitchcock's movies, with Torn Curtain being on top, and then. He climbed up a little ladder, and I always loved that there were quite beautiful women dressed as French maids. They rolled out the cake, and Mr. Hitchcock climbed the ladder and cut the layers, and everyone in the theory was that everyone in the lobby would get a slice of cake. I was not interested in cake. My mother made very good cake. What I needed was to let Mr. Hitchcock know that the guy, the little kid who was stalking him on the phone, was in the house. Mm. So I, I would say probably about 1,000 people in the lobby. It's that grand a lobby. Pardon me. And I said to my friend Richard, who was standing next to me, we were in the back, and I said, I'm going to go talk to Mr. Hitchcock now. And it was like the crowd parted, like the Red Sea. I just walked straight through and put up my hand, and we had a lovely little conversation. I had a little, one of the very first books that I can remember about Hitchcock was written by a Brit, a man named George Perry, and I had a copy of that book, and I asked Mr. Hitchcock if he would sign it. Not only did he sign it, he did his little famous silhouette. And then, I always loved it. Everyone started rushing him after we were through, asking him to sign something or other, and asking for the silhouette. And he said in a very imperious voice, "That's all I give." And he was done.
Right.
But it was that was a lovely experience, and he remembered that our conversations, and I asked him what film he was going to do next, and at that time he told me that it was Kaleidoscope, which he never got to make, thanks to Lou Wasserman and company. But anyway, so I have an odd history with Hitchcock, and then You know, when I was at Harvard, I was in actually I just started classes as a freshman year. I never completed classes because of Hitchcock, actually. But I was on vacation and I was in Los Angeles and with a group of friends, and they asked me what I would like to do while I was out. You know, during my semester break, and I don't sit still very easily. And I said, well, I'd like to interview somebody while I'm out here. And they said, well, who? I said, well, I think Alfred Hitchcock would be interesting. And I'm not kidding, Jamie. Like, this, it sounds like I'm making this up, but right on cue, someone in the room said, his telephone number is, and rattled it off. And he knew that because he worked for, this person worked for Cary Grant, and it was his responsibility to be kind of like Mr. Memory in the 39 Steps, only he had to know everything and phone numbers. And so if Cary Grant wanted to call Hitch, as he called him, then this guy would yell out phone number. You know, it was, it was kind of a, it seems, I don't want to say fated, but it sounds, my connections with Hitchcock are really very, well, I'm blessed by them, but they're very odd and almost preordained, and I can't quite figure it out. When I interviewed him, you know, it was the Harvard imprint that the Harvard University imprint that impressed him, but it and which I completely understood, and I was so lucky to get the time. But they had said that I could have 20 minutes, which I was excited and grateful for. But he gave me an hour. I was well over an hour, actually, about an hour and 20 minutes. We just hit it off, so much so that he actually spent part of the last phase of the interview telling me what I should dress, how I should dress, and what colors I should wear. And I mean, he couldn't resist this. I mean, this is just the way he was. He wanted people to be, you know, aesthetically pleasing in every way, and he knew everything there was to know about color and design and cut of fabric and tooth and all of that. And he was, I wasn't offended. I was honored. I mean, you know, that he was so willing to share. I mean, it's a hilarious thing to do. I mean, I've obviously interviewed many, many people since then, and no one's given me wardrobe pointers.
But he was giving you direction.
he was actually, yes, he was giving me direction. Well, he was also, he was pretty great because they sat me in the, they sat me in this lovely, very British-looking waiting room that was, you know, part of his suite of offices. And I was going to take a certain chair, but his assistant, I think it was Suzanne Gauthier, asked me to sit in a specific chair, which I thought, okay, that's really controlling. That's really controlling. And it's a really nice Morris chair, very elegant, wing-back kind of Morris chair. But then I realized why, because as I was sitting there, they opened the door just a crack, just enough for me to see Hitchcock swathed in a big white sheet with his neck back as his barber, Tony, had a straight-edge razor over him. It was like a tableau out of Sweeney Todd. And
wow.
Just enough time for me to see that, and then the door closed. You know, and then it was, I mean, it was so beautifully stage-managed, you know.
Wow.
It was really quite wonderful.
So your appreciation of his films must have taken hold at a pretty early age for you.
Yeah, very early. My parents were big movie fans, and I can remember them. I have a very, I am very gifted with a very, very strong memory, and I can remember as a very, very young kid, someone who would have no right to remember any of this. I can remember being in the back seat of my dad's Oldsmobile at a drive-in movie theater. That's how long ago it was, and the film was The Man Who Knew Too Much, the Doris Day James Stewart version, of course.
Right.
And I have no right to remember this, but I think, here's what I think happened. I remembered it so vividly. It had a very, very, very big impact on me. My dad was very tall and had a stammer and was thin, and wore suits and a fedora hat. My mother was very beautiful and blonde, and I thought she looked like Doris Day. So the fact that this little boy in the film, the kid Hank, whom I resembled as a kid, I think somehow it wasn't a movie for me. It looked like home movies to me. And so the fact that this little boy was being kidnapped and that his mother, who had a beautiful voice, as my mother had a beautiful voice, was a singer. And the only way I can put it is that it wasn't a movie. It was as if I were watching home movies of a vacation we took that went horribly wrong. So I really remember that. But honestly, Hitchcock movies did not click in for me until Psycho, but really they clicked in with The Birth, because then I was old enough to, I guess I was old enough to get it more fully. I mean, I do remember our watching the Hitchcock TV shows, but I don't think I really understood them. I just pretended I did,
right.
so I could be precocious, and I thought the women were really pretty. But I always found him a charming, interesting, bizarre, macabre figure, and an unlikely TV host. And I think just something about his nature, reminded me of something out of Charles Dickens. It's like Hitchcock came at me from different angles.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally the thing all sort of came together and continues to come together as this feature film version of Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho is really now finally taking shape, and I'm an executive producer and screenwriter on it. So the Hitchcock thing just continues and continues.
Well, I definitely want to know about that film version. But when you met Hitchcock and spent time with him, what did you want to know from him? What were those burning questions you had for him?
Well, what was happening was I was going to do a story for the Harvard Crimson, which I subsequently didn't do. So it was going to be a newspaper article, and it was published in the Boston Phoenix, which was the alternative the paper in Boston in the end. But to answer your question, the burning questions that I wanted to know, I really wanted to ask him and did, about motivations and what were behind specific movie choices and why did the camera move in certain ways and why were those women mostly blonde and what about those recurring themes and things like, I somehow even then I was aware I was very aware because I was, I'd been very, very interested in 70s movies and the big change in Hollywood and, the new women at the time in the 70s being, Julie Christie and Jane Fonda coming to the fore and Faye Dunaway and Peckinpah and all that great. Yeah, I was obsessed, and I'm obsessed still with Altman. So all that stuff coming together, and I was really curious how Hitchcock planned, in what was 1980 when I interviewed him, planned to continue and planned to weather that, and how movies had changed, and how technology had changed, and how the star system had collapsed. So I was very interested in talking with him about the mechanisms of movies and how those had changed for him. That's what I was interested in. Hitchcock controlled interviews. He told you what he wanted to tell you. And lots of what he talked about was, you push this button and this answer comes out. He had developed his press persona.
Well, that doesn't surprise me because we've, in previous shows that we've done, we just did something on Polanski's films.
Yes,
we're covering Robert Altman this Sunday, actually. So I'm in love with Robert Altman as you are. They're not very reflective about meanings, motivations, themes in their work. So you got that sense from Mr. Hitchcock as well.
Oh, you know, very, very clearly. And he's very much, he was very much, I talk about him a lot in the present tense. I swear to you, I'm not Norma Desmond. I do know this is past. However, he looms so large as a figure. But let me answer that question, which is, I think that he was actually quite reflective as a filmmaker and as a person and as a philosopher. He wasn't deep intellectually, which is something that I gather not just from my really brief, conversations with him, but more from people around him who spend a lot of time around him. Nor did he spend a lot of time with collaborators who were intensely intellectual. That with some very notable exceptions, but he was also very very artfully dodging all of us in terms of his films, and I think that's part of the fascination. He is he seems so accessible and so relatable, as his films are, to many, many people in many cultures, and yet, many great artists, or the ones at least that fascinate me, he is deeply inscrutable. He is finally unknowable, and I think that keeps us going back again and again to the well. I mean, lots of directors and lots of writers borrow Hitchcock tropes, but they don't get the underneath. Because maybe it's impossible to do that. But what they're not getting is, you can set up a camera angle, you can set up lighting, you can costume people in a certain way, but the deepest logic, the deepest emotional logic that was Hitchcock is finally his alone.
Yes.
You
see that with the remake. I mean, that's the purest example of that you can find.
You're talking about the remake of Psycho. Yeah, of course. And Gus Van Sant is to me a very, very gifted man and a very good director. And he couldn't have been nicer to me with that movie in terms of, inviting me out to the set and showing me footage and all of that. And, he and his crew did use the book as, a guidepost. But I could tell, talking with him at that time, that he, at least for me, it didn't feel like he understood, as if he understood what a very deep movie Psycho is.
Yeah.
He got the exterior, but if you put or allow Anne Heche. Well, maybe that's the end of that sentence. But beyond that, if you have her with a parasol, you're already not, you're not getting what the deal is with Marion Crane. What that character is, what kind of angst and pain and frustration and boredom and frustrated sexuality. Frustrated gold. She's not some Flibberty Gibbet who, on a whim, decides to steal some money and borrow a car, buy a new car, et cetera, et cetera. So, I felt like things were off there. But, even with what something that people think of as kind of a clockwork entertainment, such as Dial In for Murder. For me, a perfect murder didn't do it either. And I suspect that there is
right.
ever a remake of The Birds. They're going to miss the point, too. But I hope they don't. I mean, I'm like Tennessee Williams. Every morning I'm born a virgin. I mean, I'm reborn a virgin. I want to be proven wrong. I want for a movie director to approach or surpass Hitchcock's, vision and brilliance and worldview. And I felt over time that some filmmakers showed themselves capable of that or potentially capable of that. I mean, I remember being, very excited seeing Blood Simple for the first time.
Right.
Thinking that these and I got that same feeling, frankly, drawing a blank. The same feeling watching Javier Bardem in another Coen Brothers movie.
No Country
Now. Stalking that screen and that beautiful setup in that hotel, thinking that, you know, I don't know whether the Coen Brothers like or study or even care about Hitchcock, but there's something so original about their vision and about their way of seeing the world and about their sense of menace and of things just outside the frame that can kill you or scare you. That for me evoked Hitchcock without imitating him in the least. So,
do you find that? Excuse me. I know that not a lot of people believed in Psycho from the studio side. There was a lot of questioning as to why someone of Hitchcock's stature would choose such quote unquote unsophisticated material. But looking back, do you find that that's probably his most influential movie of his career?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I'm going to take the studio viewpoint for like 22 seconds, which is Paramount was angry with Hitchcock at this point. Look, he'd made some very successful movies for them during the early part of his contract. Certainly The Man Who Knew Too Much made a lot of money, To Catch a Thief, a big hit, A Rear Window. But when Hitch wanted to vary off the beaten path, or what Paramount saw as the beaten path, they took it in the neck. Trouble with Harry, for example, a movie that I love, didn't make any money. Vertigo, a movie that I worship, didn't make any money. North by Northwest, Hitchcock made for MGM, made a lot of money in 1959. So they were not happy with him. And they were second-guessing him, and his contract with them was ending. He was also getting older by Hollywood standards. You know, he was in his late 50s, so more second-guessing. And, Hitch was pretty imperious. I mean, they gave him the money, and he would do the movie that he wanted to make, and Paramount would have to like it or not like it or promote it or not promote it. So I think Psycho came at a very important time for Hitchcock, when he knew the walls were closing in, when he knew that other directors were being compared to him. He felt that he needed to reinvent himself, that he needed to do something very different, and Paramount didn't want to go on that journey with him. They thought, as you said, none of it was unsophisticated. It was smutty. They thought it was cheap and vulgar. And so, in fact, as you know, Jamie, so did many of the people around Hitchcock who told him, don't make this movie. Lou Wasserman didn't want him to make the movie, and, you know, Lou Wasserman had been his agent and had a father confessor. Herb Coleman, who was assistant director and a close, you know, personal friend as well as a collaborator, pretty much left Hitchcock's circle because of Psycho. Everybody knew that it wasn't a movie that he should make except for Hitchcock. So he knew that there was, I think that he was prescient. I think that he knew that the writing was on the wall for him, that he needed to come up with something entirely new. I think he saw that the times, they were changing, that audiences were way ahead of, as they usually are, of movie studios in terms of what they could quote unquote take in the way of violence, in the way of adult sexuality, in the way of language. So first time out, the screenplay, or at least the first Joseph Stefano screenplay with Hitchcock for Psycho. You know, there was a previous draft by another writer, but Joe Stefano's first script, which was pretty much what was filmed, was pretty bold. I mean, I'll take the pretty off it. It was bold. It was bold in language. It was bold in implication and innuendo. You know, in those days, audiences got innuendo, and Hitchcock knew it. I mean, that's one of the reasons why he he liked to, you know, he liked to withhold and to titillate and to tease you because your imagination and your own dirty mind or your own sense of fear and terror usually are stronger than what anyone can convey. So, but I think that Hitch thought the movie was a cakewalk, that it was something that he could do relatively quickly, relatively inexpensively, and if it didn't work, cut it for TV, cut it down to an hour, show it on television, move on to the next. And yes, it you know, the hunter got captured by the game. I mean, it did turn out to be a hugely profitable movie for him. It did become the movie that people associated with him, and it's a very atypical, in many ways, Hitchcock movie.
Yeah, it is.
And then, so to get himself out of one trap, that is, I'm getting too old, people know what to expect of me, I need to come up with something different. He came up with something that was so different in certain ways that he created another trap, which is, how do I top it? How do I frighten people in different ways? Or how do I not frighten people? And audiences and many audience members, as the box office receipts of his subsequent movies showed, never forgave him for not delivering another Psycho. So it's a one-off, this movie, in many ways, and yet it defines him.
It was so revolutionary, and it dealt with several kind of taboo subjects, and it was such a visceral experience. When I think of Psycho, I always try to imagine the audience is pouring in to see it for the first time in the year it was released. 1960, was it?
Yes, 1960. Summertime.
And what their reaction had to have been.
Unbelievable. It was one of the biggest sucker punches in the history of cinema. People didn't know what to expect. They knew what to expect considering it was Hitchcock. They, especially from the TV show, he'd become so widely known. But just think of context. Think of North by Northwest. I mean, just movie context. Think of Vertigo. You know, think of Trouble with Harry. Think of the movies that preceded it, with the exception of The Wrong Man, which is black and white and grim and French in certain ways. But they just didn't know what to expect. Didn't know what hit him, hit them. I was there. I saw it happen. Again, I was too young to really understand what was happening. But I can tell you this: I remember one of the most satisfying things in my life was seeing one of my school teachers run up the aisle, covering her mouth in sheer terror. And that was really triumphant for a kid to see a school teacher reduced to a puddle.
But, it's triumphant for me right now, just hearing about it.
Okay, well, I'm here to help. So, but I have to tell you, Jamie, I can, and you know, memory is always gilded, but I can remember the sound. I can remember certain sounds in my life, but one of the strongest was I can remember men screaming. And not the kind of screaming that you hear now at Paranormal Activity or, you know, fill in the blank, where, you know, guys are showing off for each other or their dates, you know, or they're just goofing. No, I remember screams being ripped out of guys' throats. I came from a very working-class community in southeastern Massachusetts, a mill town, when America actually had industries and we made things. And this was a town full of cotton mills. And my parents and family members worked in those mills, the textile mills. So, there was a lot of immigrant population too. So what I'm setting up here is a very macho culture, Portuguese Americans, Lebanese, workers,
right.
not college grads, not effete snobs. I mean, salt of the earth, working class people. So to hear guys that worked with my father on the night shift scream, that's not something you forget very soon. I can also remember, Jamie, being in the back seat of, once again, another back seat story, but a back seat of my mother's car when she picked up a friend of hers, Betty. Betty, well, I shouldn't say her last name, but who had already seen Psycho. My mom hadn't seen it, and I had to sneak in to see it. I wasn't allowed to see it, but off I went. But Betty was they were talking about Psycho, and my mother said, "Well, what is it?" And I remember this distinctly. My mom's friend Betty leaned into her ear and said, "It's about a queer. It's about
wow.
a queer." Mm. And because you didn't say that word aloud. Now, as it turned out, Betty didn't quite get the story correctly, because Psycho is not about a queer. It's about a queer guy, but not about a queer. But that's how it rattled people. They didn't even know what it was about. All they knew was that it was about things you weren't supposed to talk about, like transvestism and
yeah.
you know, men wearing women's clothing or wanting to become their mothers. I mean, you have to remember that this was just a few years past Christine Jorgensen, the first, a GI who had the sex change in Denmark. So
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of repression during this time and a lot of things unspoken. I mean, if you think Mad Men is fantasy land, I can tell you that it isn't, because it wasn't. So, Psycho hit a world unprepared. They were sort of unprepared. Let me put it this way. They didn't know what they were in for, but they knew they were ready for something bolder and stranger and darker.
Yeah.
And that's what hit them.
And it had to have been one of the... Yeah, I'm sorry. It had to have been one of those movies, equating it with a film and from my childhood, even though I didn't see this when I was very young, but a film like Scarface, which is so... in your face, it kind of punches you in the gut, as you said about Psycho, and you don't realize the other layers to the film. I didn't realize until years later when I rewatched it several times, this is actually a funny film and has a lot of funny moments in it. And there's a lot of kind of subversive humor I find in Psycho that had to have been lost on them from the shock of first seeing it.
Well, I can tell you, great comment. I mean, I can remember seeing films after Psycho that didn't have the same impact on me, but had visceral impact on me. For example,
right.
Bonnie and Clyde. For example, The Wild Bunch. Those movies left me shaken in terms of violence, use of humor juxtaposed with violence, brilliance of editing technique, brilliance of form and use of music and the whole plastic of cinema. But certainly Hitchcock intended the film Psycho to be very darkly funny.
Mm-hmm.
He thought it was hilarious. He told me that how funny he thought the movie was. But I honestly think that he didn't know exactly how funny until he did see it with an audience. Because Anthony Perkins told me about being at several screenings that he... I don't mean studio screenings. I mean theater showings, where people were laughing, really laughing. Not at it, but they were laughing out of nervousness.
Yes.
They certainly laughed. If you remember the moment when Norman Bates is walking up the stairs and his hips are swaying from side to side, in my community, that got roars of laughter. They got it. Lines like, Mother isn't quite herself. Those are things that you're like Scarface. You need other viewings to let that stuff really work on you. But certainly Hitchcock and Joseph Stefano, the screenwriter, layered all that in, and they were both very sardonic, funny. In Stefano's case, I would say very hip, New York witty, glib kind of guy. So, those things were all intended, but it really takes the alchemy of a movie, its time, what's going on in the world, context, and that dialogue with an audience to let you, as a filmmaker, know just how funny or scary or dull or whatever it is your movie mm-hmm. is. So Hitchcock learned a lot with Psycho, but let's remember, Jamie, that he thought about hiring a psychologist and a psychiatrist to do testing and figure out what made Psycho work, because he wanted to do it again, or he wanted to do something again that might allow him to play the audience like an organ.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, he was cheap, and he didn't want to spend the money. And he probably figured, look, it's not going to work anyway. No one's ever going to be able to really tell me, you know, why it worked and why it didn't. You know, it's part,
right.
part of the zeitgeist. But I do want to say as an aside that here's something that I think lots of people don't know, but it's pretty brilliant. One of the men that he wanted to hire, one of the doctors that he wanted to hire as the expert to tell him why Psycho worked with audiences, and he was going to pay him a lot of money to do this, was in fact one of the doctors who, on television and in the press, was railing against Hitchcock and Psycho and wanted it banned and said what a destructive movie it was and how it was leading to real-life violence. So Hitchcock, in a way, was wanting to buy this guy off. And from what I understand is how he finally bought him off so that he didn't have to pay for the survey was he agreed to do a kind of duel with him in an interview for a then-popular magazine called Red Book, which got the doctor a lot of attention, got Psycho a lot of attention, got Hitchcock a lot of attention, and meant that he made a friend out of an enemy.
Mm.
So he was a brilliant guy at co-opting people.
I think of Anthony Perkins in the film, and it's one of those perfect performances. It's everything. It's funny, it's awkward, it's vulnerable and heartbreaking and frightening. It's everything. And I'm wondering what Hitchcock's, what his view was of Perkins' contribution to that film, because when I read quotes from him concerning the film, he always singles out Herman for being so instrumental in the success of that film. But I don't necessarily read him speaking about Perkins.
Another good question. Hitchcock used to say that if he could get 80% of his original vision, then he was lucky. He also said that casting is 90% of the process and 90% of whether the movie will work or it won't. Now, he was brilliant in casting Anthony Perkins in many ways. Perkins owed Paramount a movie, and so he could be gotten really inexpensively. Perkins was unhappy with what Paramount was doing with him. You have to remember, this guy was being built up as the next James Dean,
mm-hmm.
slash James Stewart. So lots of money was being put into Anthony Perkins to create him into the image of a movie star. Now, Hitchcock also knew about because Hitchcock was a great gossip, I can attest to that, because he gave me some. But he loved gossip, and he knew everything about the personal life of actors. And he knew a great deal about the personal life, or the rumored personal life, of Anthony Perkins. And he knew, or he thought he knew, that playing Norman Bates would be a huge risk for any actor. But particularly then for an actor who is being given the big build-up and about whom all these whispers were around town, that he was, if not gay, then bi.
Mm-hmm.
And but in those days, really, the rumors were that he was bi, and many people knew that he had a relationship with another film star, a big heartthrob at the time, Tab Hunter. So
yeah.
It was kind of brilliant casting in many ways. I'm eliminating or not stressing the fact that Perkins, given the right material, was a phenomenal actor. And he had really good material a really good script, and he had really good raw material. Hitchcock was enormously grateful to Perkins, as he should be. He sent him a telegram when he was not nominated for an Academy Award, that he was ashamed of his fellow actors. That's a very big, generous gesture on Hitchcock's part, who took most of the credit for everything and rarely gave actors credit. He loved Anthony Perkins. He spent a lot of time with him. He played word games with him on the set. He liked Janet Leigh, and he liked Perkins, and he was cruel and dismissive of Vera Miles and John Gavin. Perkins and Janet Leigh were the favorite kids. He loved that Perkins came up with the idea of chewing candy corn in the movie. He loved that Perkins and Martin Balsam had worked out that wonderful interrogation scene where they overlapped dialogue, where they because they shot it straight. They shot it less sort of off the cuff and more the script. But he had such respect. Well, he had great respect for Martin Balsam, but he had such respect for Anthony Perkins that he let them try it their way, and those are the takes that he used. And it caused a lot of problems in terms of, editing and looping and all of that. But he didn't care because the spontaneity of the scene was so electric. So
was that unusual for him? Because when I think of Hitchcock, his films seem to be so tightly controlled. Was allowing for that kind of spontaneity unusual for him, or was that par for the course?
It wasn't par for the course, really. But when he really respected the actor and trusted the actor and knew they could do it, he would let someone like James Stewart or Cary Grant or Anthony Perkins play. And they played so naturally to their own strengths as screen personae, always within the framework of the character, that he knew that he could relax and just let them fly. Now, his movies were, as you say, they were really mapped out, storyboarded. All camera angles were worked out in advance. Although that's kind of a canard too, because he was open to experimentation and improvisation. If someone he respected had a better idea, he'd listen. Not only would he listen, he would do it. He had great respect for Janet Leigh. He really liked her a great deal. And, he basically told her, look, as long as you are in the place that I need you to be, that is the physical place that I need you to be when my camera moves from here to here or that I cut to you, then you can do whatever you want within that frame. And, that may sound to some people very controlling. For some actors, like Janet Leigh, who told me this again and again, she loved it. Because she had Janet's MO when she got any script, particularly the Psycho script, was she would write a complete history of the character from birth, and she shared that with Hitchcock and with Mrs. Hitchcock, and they loved it. She knew what perfume Marion Crane would wear. She knew what books and magazines she would read, what she would subscribe to, what record albums, how's that for an archaic reference, but she knew what record albums would be in her collection. See, and so Hitchcock and Alma, who was his right-hand person, knew that someone like Janet could be trusted. She had thought it out. That's all he ever wanted to know, have you really thought this through? And if they had, and if they had come to him, already from a place of competence, and, wisdom and charisma and all of that, he would just let them go with it. So so yes and no is the answer to your question.
Hitchcock, you mentioned that he felt like he had to raise his game another notch with Psycho. And I'm thinking, when I think of Hitchcock and the decades in which he worked, He was never defined by the trend at the time or that particular decade. He was always so timeless. But when movies started to change, particularly in the 70s, what was his relationship to the new filmmakers? Was there a competition in him?
Well, there were those. I mean, he liked to talk about. When interviewers would ask him what contemporary movie makers do you like? He would punt and just, you know, not really answer them. But the fact is he would watch everything, everything. And
yeah.
He would screen it in his office. He was particularly in love with, as am I, with Michelangelo Antonioni.
Mm.
Blow Up was a seminal movie for Hitchcock. And his plans for a film called Kaleidoscope, which would have been not a successor to Psycho, but you know, would have been another psychopathic killer of a different kind. That film was all planned out in terms, and actually the story almost was told in terms of color, pattern, background. This is all influenced by Hitchcock himself, because he was obsessed by color and form and music and, again, the plastic of cinema. But he saw with people like Antonioni, with Red Desert and Blow Up, how they used color in such a bold and interesting and evocative psychological pattern. So
yeah.
That Kaleidoscope film was really planned out in terms of those things. And so he wasn't getting the screenplay that he wanted, but he was very aware. That movie had, or the way it was planned, Kaleidoscope, some of the ideas were fed into finally the movie called Frenzy that was released. But Kaleidoscope was, he was going to shoot it with non-pros. At one point he wanted Robert Redford to do it, the very young Robert Redford. But he was very, very aware that the film would have been more sexual. The dialogue would have been even more frank than Psycho, as it needed to be, you know, as we're going into the 70s, that the story would be more elliptical, with many things unexplained. So I think he was with it. Universal wasn't with it. They wanted him to do another North by Northwest somehow, and
right.
that's part of how he got into trouble with Torn Curtain, which is not a 70s movie, but a, you know, mid 60s movie. Frenzy is more, or was more, his attempt to do something more contemporary. But really, it's almost like one of his silent movies, like The Lodger, done with some 70s trappings.
Mm-hmm.
It's a movie that really bears rewatching. But I think once again that he was aware that time was passing, that that people like Truffaut and especially Antonioni and Fellini, whom he adored, were doing new things. They were telling stories in different ways. They were using actors in different ways. They were using costume in different ways. And he was catching up. I'm sorry, all he needed was more financially successful movies, and Universal might have left him alone. But the movies were the birds cost a lot of money. Marnie wasn't successful. You know, you just go on, and then you're getting older, you're losing your confidence, and studio people, bosses start telling you what your audiences want. And it's really over for any artist when that happens, if they listen. And, you know, by the 70s and moving into toward the 80s, Hitchcock didn't have the emotional reserves, nor did he have the reserves of good health, nor did he have the intimate bond with an audience that he had had earlier. And he lost his nerve.
Mm.
And time outran him.
Well, even so, there were definitely filmmakers and films that paid homage to Hitchcock's style. I mean, the most obvious is De Palma in the 70s. Yeah. Did he take that as insult, or was he flattered by it, do you think?
Well, I'll tell you what he told me. I asked him what he thought of these Valentines that other directors were making to him. You know, whether it was Brian De Palma or you know, Mel Brooks or Claude Chabrol. And his answer was typical. He just winked at me and he said, "Well, I love being made love to." I think he was fine with it. But I think he kept thinking, "Wait till they see what I'm going to come up with." You know, as I did in previous decades, I'm going to reset how people think of me. I'm going to recalibrate the dialogue, and I'm going to create my own new trend. Well, look, Billy Wilder was floundering at the same time. Howard Hawks, you know, in the late 60s was having a difficult time. The screenplays weren't there anymore. So yeah. Hitchcock was going after Edward Albee, and he was going after Vladimir Nabokov. He was going after Lillian Hellman. He was going after really interesting people who were saying no. So what was he to do? You know, he wanted to keep making movies, but the great writing wasn't there anymore, and the great stories weren't there anymore. At least as he saw them. So, yeah. but he was turning down Rosemary's Baby, and he was turning down the death traps of the world, and he was turning down Sleuth. So he felt like he'd done those movies before. And yeah. With Rosemary's Baby, what he told me was he couldn't figure out how devils worked. He didn't, you know, he just couldn't figure out how a devil cult would not be laughable. Well, certainly the great Mr. Polanski figured out a way to do that. Even if it's not his most personal film, it's certainly brilliantly crafted. And Hitch couldn't find a way to do that. And he loved Polanski as well. He should. After all, Polanski films introduced him to Catherine Deneuve, and Catherine Deneuve was his next woman that he wanted to use in his film that he never made called The Short Night.
Another stunning blonde.
Another stunning blonde and a terrific actress and an icon. But I think they could have made beautiful music together, and she certainly wanted to work with him. I mean, he loved Buñuel, so, you know, he or she was working for Truffaut and Buñuel. I mean, you can't get better than that.
Now, your film. Let's talk a little bit about your film. I know I've been reading about this for years. And I understand you've it's a long process.
Have.
I know. Where are we with this now? With the film?
You know, well after a writer's strike, an actor's strike, a director who worked on it beautifully for a year, and then just got too busy with other things. You know, we're back on track and. You know, the financing is in place. We have our leading man and suggestion of a leading woman. We've got, you know, it's kind of an embarrassment, Jamie, really, with the numbers of really great actors who've wanted to step up and play Janet Leigh and Vera Miles and John Gavin. And the tough one is really Anthony Perkins. That's a very tough role to cast, but... I think it's going to be surprising to people. I don't think people know what movie it's going to be. I think there are some people who call me or contact me or write me and want to know how the documentary is going. It's not a documentary. I mean, it's a feature film, and it's. I think it's going to surprise people. I think it's. I think the simplest way for me to say it is basically a film about Mr. and Mrs. Hitchcock as they're making Psycho, and how their relationship is influencing the movie as it's being shot, and how the film is influencing their relationship.
That's exactly the movie I want to see, what you're describing. So that sounds amazing. Now, so you're in search of a director now?
There are conversations ongoing with directors. Once again, we have been bombarded with directors who want to do it, and it's kind of mind-boggling. I mean, it really is. I'm not being like faux modest here.
I can imagine. Yeah.
It Well, see, that surprises me, Jamie, because Hitchcock is tough, and there are, I would think that there would be some directors who would shy away because, oh my God, are people going to expect a Hitchcock movie that is going to be like a Hitchcock movie or look mm-hmm. like or feel like a Hitchcock movie? And that's a, you know, and that's a tone and a, that's a, those are aesthetic decisions that, let me put it this way, certainly the screenplay as written would allow someone who wants to make a Hitchcockian movie do that. But we're talking about household names, directors that if you dream about would say, yeah, I want to do this movie. So mm-hmm. It'll be interesting to see and I think the decision will finally be made within the next 4 weeks, how this is going to go. But, you know, lots of creative elements are already in place. But we have, and I have been adamant about this, deliberately been keeping things quiet. Off the IMDb,
right.
Off the Twitter, off the Facebook, off the everything, so that, you know, there can be some surprises for people.
Is this independently financed, or is it a studio film, a Universal, or who's behind this?
Well, the people that are behind it have a film coming out called Up in the Air with George Clooney.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is going to be quite a big movie this year. And
that's
going to
be the major Oscar contender. We've been talking it up on the show, yeah.
Well, have you seen it?
I haven't been able to see it, no. I'm just going on buzz alone.
Well, you're in for quite a treat. It's a remarkable movie. So I'm very pleased and honored to be in the presence of filmmakers, because the people behind this company are movie makers. Tom Pollock used to run Universal, and he has impeccable aesthetic taste. So we're in brilliant hands, and the company does have relationships with film studios. Up in the Air is Paramount. So I would really like it if this film were released by the studio that made Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be a sort of a nice aesthetic and creative kind of. It'd be charming, I would say.
I think so too. Yeah.
And I think it would be poetic justice in a strange kind of way. The studio that didn't want to make Psycho and made a fortune from it is now perhaps releasing the movie that is made about the making of Psycho.
Oh, that would be beautiful.
I appreciate the irony.
Yeah. So can you confirm Hopkins?
All that I can confirm, and as he stammers, all that I can confirm is that Mr. Anthony Hopkins has been attached to this project from the beginning and tells us he wants nothing more than for this movie to finally happen so that he can sink his teeth into this role.
Good enough. I have to fish for my scoop.
I completely understand.
But when this comes to fruition, come back and talk to us as much as you're comfortable talking to us about it. We'd love to have you back on.
Well, I'd love that. I had a really good time doing this. And, you know, when an actor would blossom under Hitchcock, it's not very much different. When an interviewee has an interviewer who is smart and listens and asks interesting questions, that allows you to come forth. So,
oh, that's so kind of you. And I was so intimidated because you're one of the best journalists and interviewers that I've had the pleasure of reading. So it's always intimidating when you're interviewing an expert interviewer. So that's very kind of you.
Well, I really appreciate back at you. I appreciate your saying that. And to answer your question, I'd love to come back, and hopefully I won't need to be as circumspect next time. But I am an old fashioned guy. I mean, I think people should go to the movies and get surprised.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to spill the beans, but I think that people will be in for an interesting ride when they see the film, and they're going to be in for some surprises, and I can't wait to see it myself.
All right, the Stephen Rebello got a ton of great stuff on Hitchcock.
You got tons of great stuff there, definitely.
Let's talk about this movie, Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho, a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
As movie geeks, and we fantasize about certain things, this was set to go, or set up a couple of years ago, and it was announced for director Ryan Murphy, who did Running with Scissors. And he seemed very, like, an odd choice to me. Like, not someone I would automatically equate with making a film like this.
Mm-hmm. What had he done before Running with Scissors?
I know of Running with Scissors. I'm not sure beyond that.
You know, because if you look at Running with Scissors, it's a hard movie. It's not a great, you know, in anticipation, if you read the book, it's a disappointment, obviously. But there's some truth to, there's some legitimacy with that choice. Some, not a lot, but there's some. You could say, okay, I could see this guy handling this.
Well, you either have, like, it directed in a straight fashion, or, as Mr. Ribello said, the screenplay is written to allow someone to direct it in a Hitchcockian style, which is fascinating to me. And as a kind of movie geek fantasy, like I've been saying,
mm-hmm.
they're going to decide on a director soon. They have several candidates. I would love to see this movie go to De Palma.
Well, who wouldn't? All right, on this show, I mean, who the hell wouldn't want to see? This is De Palma's baby.
Mm-hmm.
This could redeem every bad film he's ever made.
Well, who is more suited to this film? It's, I mean, Ryan Murphy, of course, he's behind Nip Tuck. You asked about him.
Yeah, Nip Tuck. All right, Nip Tuck's great and everything. That's great for the perverts who watch that on, I guess, Wednesday nights now. But no, De Palma owns this. De Palma should get this.
Yeah.
De Palma, just watch Carrie. Just watch Obsession.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Forget everything that comes after that or before that. Watch those two films. De Palma, this should be De Palma's crowning achievement. And I don't care who you are. I don't care, you know, what film executive, what money changer has limited cinematic experience. They don't know the history. No, De Palma should do this. And
I think so.
If I've insulted anyone on this, that's too bad.
No, I mean, anyone that listens to our show knows that we would push for De Palma. And people are...
I would push for De Palma to do a lot of things, but definitely this, more so than anything else.
People are already asking us to start a petition for De Palma.
Well, we
so
should. I mean,
I will put in that suggestion. All right, I think this is our good friend Bonnie on the phone. I'm hoping it is.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I wanted to piggyback a little bit on what you were talking about as far as the difference between suspense and gore.
Yeah.
In that, well, I think part of what sets Hitch apart is that if you look at his films, they're relationship films.
Yeah, they are.
There's something there beyond just the suspense. There's something else going on there. If you look at any of his films, you can see that. And particularly in Psycho, you've got the complicated relationship between mm-hmm. him and his mother. Even though she's dead.
Yeah.
It's the definitive bad mother-son relationship of all time.
Which Hitchcock, I think, from what I read, channeled a lot of his feelings about his very strict mother into Psycho. I mean, his mother was very, very strict and stern with him. I want to get your take, Bonnie, on the remake, because I want to make this argument.
Yeah, I'm waiting. I know you want to make this argument. I remember the argument.
I'm in the minority here.
I've never seen it, and
okay.
Probably never will. I have no desire.
Why
mess with it? If it ain't broke, you don't fix it. I've always had an issue with remakes. They're very, very seldom are they better or... than the original, and it always cracks me up when they come out. A lot of times when you have a remake come out and people are going, oh, did you see that new movie? And you go, no, that wasn't new.
Wait, someone
you know,
said
there
that
was one before that.
Now, I'm going to give my take on it.
Oh, sure.
Okay. And then we're going to accept another call. So, Bonnie, if you want to stay on the line, that'll be awesome.
Okay.
Here's my thought on it. The remake was enticing because it was truly a remake. Van Sant wanted to make it shot for shot, time the shots the same, blah, blah, blah. And within that frame, the actors, using the same script, the actors could interpret as they wanted. Only one actor, I think, set out, James Remar, set out to play it exactly as it had been played in the original. I think that's a worthy experiment and a failed film, because there really is something that cannot be defined, an artist's fingerprint that is clearly on Hitchcock's Psycho that works.
You read my mind there.
Using the same schematics, the exact same thing on Van Sant's, it doesn't work at all.
Right.
I think it'll be a great idea, because Van Sant has actually said, I want to remake this again in 15 years. Because an artist changes, and I would love to see how the movie changes with the artist. I'm precious about Psycho in that, you know, it's a great classic. There's no way that this remake could ever approach that film, but as an experiment, it fascinated me.
Well, yeah, it would be a great study in a film class to look at the two and to explore that.
Yeah.
You know, what is it, that essence that makes it work here and not here?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so that is very interesting, and that's exactly what I was going to say. That's why it wouldn't work, because he's not Hitchcock.
Right, and that's why I'm remaking Gone with the Wind next week. So.
You are remaking Gone with the Wind.
See, yeah.
How are you
going to afford
the tracking shot?
It'll be done in my backyard.
Really?
Yeah. So Bonnie, ideas for casting for Alfred Hitchcock in the making of Psycho. Do you have any?
Bonnie is still on the line.
Hitchcock?
That's awesome.
Yes.
Of Hitchcock himself? Well, I had mentioned in the chat room Evan Handler.
That's
someone
a good
else
choice.
Mentioned, Giamatti, who I think would be wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely agree that Perkins is going to be the more difficult one to cast, I think.
See, my take, my feeling is that Hopkins is in, that he's been in for a couple of years as Hitchcock, and he's talked about it in interviews, how excited he is about it. I think maybe Marcia Gay Harden or someone of that sort is up for the wife, from rumors that I've read, for Alma Hitchcock. You're right, Norman Bates, Anthony Perkins, that would be
what
an impossible...
What about Vincent D'Onofrio?
That's a very intriguing choice, as is Jeremy Davies.
Yeah, Jeremy Davies is a very good choice, too.
Yeah, I don't know.
Let's just hope it's not Zac Efron.
we were talking about that yesterday with some friends. Now, Zac Efron is in the Me and Orson Welles film.
Right.
Oh, God.
Well, even just physically, though, I mean, if you look at Perkins and then you look at actors today, he's awkward. You know, so capturing that awkwardness, the physicality there is, I think, would be, I almost would lean towards a comedian that would have the chops to do it dramatically because of the physicality of the role.
What about Jim Carrey?
You know,
honestly,
that was who came to my mind when we were, you know, in chat and you brought the whole subject up.
Just look at
Jim Carrey.
In his physical comedies, forget the serious films, but just look at him in Yes Man, and I know that might be an odd choice, but just look at that, and you could see like an Anthony Perkins mystique there. I definitely see that.
He's got the frame. He's got the physicality. He has the ability. The only stumbling block would be, can we as an audience get over the Jim Carrey?
Yes, we can.
Would it outshine? Would the Jim Carrey outshine the project? I don't know.
I think it could.
Yeah.
If you look at the Cable Guy, which was way ahead of its time as far as like trusting Jim Carrey with something other than being like a zany guy, I think he could do it. I really do.
Well, in Truman Show.
In Truman Show, or look, even Man on the Moon, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. But really, the Cable Guy is this movie that comes early on, where he's able to play this really dark, unlikable character. And I'm not saying Anthony Perkins is unlikable, but I sense in the terms of playing Norman Bates, That's the first role I would go to from Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what other role I'd actually go to? And you might laugh at this, but because it wasn't wildly received at the time, Me, Myself, and Irene.
I love that movie. Actually,
yeah, no,
that movie cracks
me
up.
But it wasn't, let's be honest, it wasn't, you know, not, the people weren't clamoring up for that one when it came out. But those roles would be, I agree, I think Bonnie's got a really good point here. Those two roles, could, I would definitely, I would put Carrie at the front of the line.
My concern would be, once Jim Carrey signs up for something, it becomes the Jim Carrey movie.
Mm-hmm.
That's
well,
true.
My concern is his age, too, though. I almost think he is too old.
Could be.
Because Faith is young in that film.
Even though he's made of rubber. I mean, he can do anything
right.
with Faith.
Right.
Yeah, I
could
do it, but I understand what you mean, Jamie. It is when you put such a big-name actor in that kind of part, it does overshadow everything. So.
Well, honestly, I don't know the guy very well because I've only seen him a couple times, but physically, as far as how he looks, and you're going to laugh at me now and say you're crazy, but on SNL, there's a new player on SNL that actually looks very similar to Carrey, a young version of Jim Carrey.
Okay.
You know, I know nothing about his background. I know nothing, you know, as far as his experience, but physically, I think he could do it.
And who is this gentleman?
I don't know his name.
No, but okay,
that's
no,
horrible.
That's not wrong. That's not. No, I understand what you're saying. I think that it's almost, you know, for when you get such, you know, you're saying, okay, Anthony Perkins, and to a lot of us, we think Norman Bates, but he's also in a lot of other great films too. It almost might be beneficial. Nine times out of ten, it's beneficial to get an unknown, because the problem with putting Jim Carrey and Anthony Perkins is, you know, when you sell that idea to a majority of the American movie-going public, they want liar, liar.
You're selling an expectation there,
yeah.
Commercially.
So when they get Anthony Perkins, it's like what they did with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is, his best role to date. They want, though, I guess what they'll get from this animated Christmas Carol in a couple of weeks, but they want something else, but he's going to give them something totally different.
Okay, so Bonnie's voting for Tina Fey for Anthony Perkins.
Really? Tina Fey?
No,
awesome.
She could probably
that's
do
like
it.
So awesome.
Yeah, you know, if there's been any discussion of M. Night, because there's so much reference to him and how he reflects Hitchcock's style.
I pretty much would guarantee M. Night would probably jump all over it.
Yeah.
It would be a happening.
The most positive reference ever made to the movie The Happening.
Just that The Happening. Yeah. That'll be great. Okay, North by Northwest, Bonnie. Is that a favorite of yours, too?
Actually, Rear Window is my real favorite of his.
Well, that's too bad, because I want to talk about North by Northwest.
We have a call online. Oh, my God.
We have
I can hang up then, Jamie.
No, you can hang on. The North by Northwest, it's a special edition DVD. I wanted to bring this up before we close the show. It comes out in stores November 3rd from Warner Brothers. It is 50th anniversary. That's my birthday
store,
present
store,
to you.
Yeah, store.
It's a 50th anniversary edition of it, so it's been 50 years, and it's restored from the original Vista Vision elements. And it looks gorgeous. If you see frame grabs and comparisons with previous versions of this film's DVD incarnation, it's stunning. And it's got great extras on it. It's got this wonderful documentary on Cary Grant, a fascinating guy who took his craft very seriously. He really wanted to be as effortless as possible, and he worked very hard in that vein. And I think it's pretty safe to say that North by Northwest is if not the, it's definitely one of the quintessential Cary Grant performances.
It's one of the, but it's not the quintessential, but it's definitely one of them, but not the quintessential.
Well, many people testify that it is.
I would go with Gunga Din.
Yeah, he was most proud of Gunga Din.
I'm proud
career.
Of Gunga Din. Well, I'm not going to go with the other people that are proud of Gunga Din. I'm not going to go with the other people that are proud of Gunga Din, because it's really, Gunga Din is like... you know, there are some unsavory characters in world history that love Gunga Din, mm-hmm. and we're not going to go there.
Well, Hussein's favorite movie was The Godfather. So I still love
Hitler's
The Godfather.
Hitler's favorite movie. You know what Hitler's favorite movie is? Gunga Din, King Kong, and The Lives of the Bengal Lancer.
Wow.
Yeah.
That'll be our next show.
Hitler's favorite film, followed by Stalin's double feature. I mean,
there's also there's a great documentary in here in this two-disc set. It's also on Blu-ray, I think, in a one-disc
set. It is?
Yeah, on November 3rd.
That's awesome.
That four or five directors, including Friedkin and Del Toro, Curtis Hanson, all Warner Brothers directors,
mm-hmm.
oddly enough.
Oh,
yeah. They discuss the work of Hitchcock, and in particular North by Northwest. And they go through the movie with you, like each beat of the movie in this documentary. And they explain what makes it unique, what makes it special, especially Hitchcockian, and why it works so well. Really cutting-edge stuff. And this was a really elaborate production on Hitchcock's part. I think he went $1 million over budget. But the studio
not
didn't care.
Bad.
Because
that means nothing by today's standards.
All right, there's still a $3 million. I mean, come on. You know? Those were the days. And you know how North by Northwest started, Bonnie?
How, Jamie? I know you're going to tell me.
Yeah, here's some trivia. Hitchcock told a screenwriter, the one that eventually wrote North by Northwest, he said, you know what I've always wanted to see? I've always wanted to see a murder at the UN building. And then a couple of weeks later, he called him up and said, you know, I've always wanted to end a movie with a big climactic fight on Mount Rushmore. So with that, the screenwriter had to piece together that beginning and end and come up with a screenplay to fill in the middle. And it's a great piece of work. So look out for that. You can purchase it, pre-order it on our website here by clicking that icon. Take you to Amazon, and you can buy North by Northwest for its November 3rd release. I recommend it.
I'll be there.
Here's what we're closing off with tonight. Befitting,
okay.
A show about Psycho, and we'll be back on Wednesday.
Sweet.